And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to a Monday edition of The Low Post podcast, where we are about to say the three most anticipated words in the history of niche NBA podcasting, or niche NBA podcasting, as some people like to say. Not me. I'm a niche guy. What up, Beck?
What up? Niche. I think niche. Not niche. Niche, niche sounds like Nietzsche, which I'm probably also mispronouncing.
I want to say it's Nietzsche, but as I say that, I'm like not 100% sure. Yeah. Should, went to college and graduate school. Should probably know the correct way to pronounce Friedrich Nietzsche's name. Probably 0 for 2 on Friedrich and Nietzsche.
40 seconds in and we've both already lost our English degrees, or at least I lost mine.
Yeah. You want to talk about Michel Foucault for a while and, you know, talk about whatever. Anyway. So we are on the verge of my favorite thing.
The finals?
Not the finals. The finals have a chance to be really good. But not my favorite thing. But I think Shea Serrano, friend of the program, once did a ranking of each of the seven games of a playoff series. And I think he ranked game four last as like the least interesting game of. And it almost ended our friendship, which is almost a virtual friendship because I see him once a year. So it's not a real friend. We're friends, but we're not, you know, I almost had to just cut him out. I think game four of a 2-1 series, it's like, obviously, if the team that's behind wins, each game then takes on increasingly dramatic, you know, qualities. But game four, it's the whole series. If Milwaukee wins tomorrow, it's over. And if Toronto wins tomorrow, then it's a best of three, and we're like as tense as it gets. Game four is the thing that determines the entire course of the series. If it's 2-1.
You're saying a team could not come back from a 3-1 deficit? Is that what you're
saying? I'm saying this. Everyone's like, oh, Toronto saved their season. Saved their season with a great double overtime game three slugfest rock fight win. They did. Season saved. Guess what? You got to come back and save it again tomorrow. Because here's how many times the Bucks have lost three games in a row this year. Do you know? Zero times. You know how many times they lost two games in a row? One time. You are not look, it's possible. Anything's possible. It's possible I could walk out and get struck by lightning tomorrow night when there's a lightning storm or something. I would bet a lot of money. I guess we can do that. I can go to New Jersey and actually do this. I can put my literal money where my literal mouth is. I would bet a lot of money on Milwaukee winning one of three remaining games with two in Milwaukee. But so this is what I'm saying. Game four, I'm going to Toronto tomorrow, my home away from home in the NBA, because I want to be there for game four.
I think it's going to be a great game to go to. I think it's a great game. Should be a great game, period, and yes, pivotal moment. I don't want to downplay the importance of a game four and offend you as Shea Serrano has. I do think we've seen enough 3-1 comebacks, including one fairly memorable one, that it doesn't feel as big to me. I don't know is it as pivotal as the game five when the series is tied at 2-2, and we know that the vast majority of those series go to the team that wins the game five? Of a 2-2 series?
This is my least favorite stat. The winner of game X is likely to win this. The winner of every game is likely to win.
But it's more. It's more so. Like, winning game one is like, I don't know, 70-something percent. But being up 2-0, you jump up to like, I don't know, 78% or something.
I have a stat for you. You ready?
I'm ready.
The winner of game seven has never lost a playoff series. It's never happened one time. Okay, so Toronto. I feel like this is not the first time in recent podcasts you have come on and offended me with some disagreement.
Within
that hits
3 minutes?
You're becoming like a little Tyrion Lannister character arc where you're going a little downhill right now. We need to get back on the same page.
I mean, at least I'm still alive. I'm not in jail. I got my little hand of the somebody pin back.
From Kuzma?
Things are looking up for Tyrion. I'm okay.
Is the king LeBron when he has the hand of the king thing on? We assume that's LeBron, right? Like Kyle Kuzma is saying LeBron is my king. I'm the serving here as the hand of the king at the draft lottery.
That seems, yes. That is sound analogizing by
the
Kuzma.
Game of Zones guys are just on fire.
F***ing killing it. That's right. I can't cuss on this podcast.
The lottery gods. Okay, first of all, I'm not going to lie. When I saw that they had a lottery one and that the lottery gods were being invoked and of the lottery gods of whatever kingdoms in the NBA, there was like a tiny bit of me that the vain part of me that was like, maybe I'm going to be in Game of Zone because nobody loves the lottery more than me. And then it was just Mark Tatum who being funny. I enjoy Mark Tatum's performance at the lottery every year. I enjoyed LeBron's appearance on Game of Zones, just bad mouthing all the other teams. It was great.
It was epic. The Malamute brothers who make Game of Zones are absolutely killing it this season. That one was spectacular. Of course, the Jimmy Butler episode that opened the new Game of Zones season was just over the top, incredible, uproarious. I've watched it like 17 times and I still laugh every single time. They've been awesome. I love the lottery probably as much as you do. I don't want to offend you again. So I'm going to say I love the lottery 99% as much as you do.
No, that's okay. We can all love the lottery. There's enough room for everyone to love the lottery.
It is irrationally one of my favorite things. And their spoof of it was spectacular. People, go watch Game of Zones if you hadn't seen it.
Also, the Toronto trade one was great. And I will never – I'm sorry for Jakob Poeltl, who I like and have interacted with many times. He's always going to be Jake Poeltl
Jake
to
Poeltl.
Me from now on. Jake Poeltl. And Dirk on his NBA deathbed talking to Porzingis and Doncic, and then Maxi Kleba as the third Dirk was tremendous. And the best one was asking Porzingis to justify why he was – leaving his original house, and Porzingis says the word Knicks. Oh, yeah, I understand completely. Say no more. Anyway,
James Dolan's shouting from the balcony in the lottery.
You're banned.
Yeah.
You're banned. It's great. It was just great. So okay, we're going to game four. Pivotal. I mean, this is it.
I don't know if it's it, but
no, I'm saying right. This is. I think both of these teams could talk themselves in, especially Milwaukee more than this, to a puncher's chance against the Warriors with Durant. We'll talk about Durant later.
Yeah.
Puncher's chance. Toronto is puncher's chance. Toronto is underdog, but puncher's chance. Milwaukee is more than that. Milwaukee is, okay, that's interesting. Even if Durant is playing, that's more interesting than any. It may not be as competitive in length of games as the Rocket series last year, but stylistically, it's going to be more interesting. It would be more interesting. So there's a temptation, I think, to look at last night's game and say, okay, Giannis, Bledsoe, and Middleton shot a combined 13 of 48, I think, with 9,000 turnovers. And the Raptors made 17 threes, and Norman Powell had his, thrice annual Norman Powell game. But by the way, kudos to Norman Powell for maintaining the ultra-serious borderline stink face, stone face during these games where he hits threes and does stuff. Cause I would be going crazy if I were him. He looks angry the whole time. There's a temptation to look at all of this and say 20 turnovers for the Bucks. Say, well, they almost won anyway.
Yeah.
This is just a lucky win for the Raptors. The Bucks are going to come and do the thing that the favorite always does in this game four, which is to win the step on the throat game. Was something here real to you? Do the Raptors now, is this ahead? I mean, again, a road team hasn't won yet. Is this a head-on fight to you now?
Yeah, it is. Listen, quick aside, among my least favorite NBA-isms, NBA playoff-isms, cliches, the they just held serve thing, I've been ranting about this for weeks already, it's just dumb. It's dumb because of the stat that you already crapped on a little while ago. If you're up 2-0, you're going to win the series about 78 or whatever percent of the time. And so it's not just
because you're better.
Right. No. And you started at home, but it shows how important it is to actually steal one of those first two games if you are the road team. If you go down 2-0, one, you weren't the better team already anyway, because chances are you went down 2-0 on the road and you already had a worse record. And two, you're just behind the eight ball now and you've eventually got to win on the other team's floor. So 2-0, if it's just the home team, quote unquote, holding serve, by the way, don't bring tennis into this.
You got a problem with tennis?
No, I'm just saying it's basketball. We don't need a tennis analogy.
You know what
basketball.
I have an issue with? You know what really grinds
this is
my
really,
gears?
This is a really long stare. I'm a little scared.
Let them wear something besides white at Wimbledon. Get off your freaking high horse.
Completely. Yeah. And let golfers wear shorts. It's like 100 blazing degrees out there.
Oh, that's don't even get me started on that.
Let golfers wear whatever the hell they want to. You didn't just hold serve. It's important to actually steal one of those games if you're the road team. That said, in this series, these two teams were incredibly closely matched. The Raptors load managed Kawhi in 22 games, and if they don't, they might have had the better home regular season record. They might have started with home court advantage. Which, by the way, if this thing comes down to having to win, or when it comes down to having to win a road game, if that's game 5 or game 7. Will we talk at some point about, hey, Did they maybe overdo it? How important was load management during the season versus home court now? It hasn't come up much. I feel like maybe that will at some point here soon. But I think these teams are very, very close. And I think that the Bucks sometimes look more dominant than maybe they actually are. They have one supreme talent in Giannis, and a perfect set of role players around him. And on any given night, a couple of those guys hit, they look unbeatable. But they're not. This is not the Warriors at full strength with four All-Stars. This is not, they're not the traditional super team of this era. They're built a little differently. And it's not to say that they're vulnerable, they're this, they're that. I just think the Toronto Raptors are also very, very good and great at home. And it's not going to surprise me at all if this thing is 2-2 and we're down to the best of three and all of a sudden home court and the lack of home court advantage is going to matter.
Yeah, I agree with you. The Raptors won 58 games and were two games back despite the management of the loads. And this is why you don't proclaim a dynasty after a team has won the first two games of the Eastern Conference Finals and by implication, bury the team that is now playing at home.
Well, and how quickly do we bury Toronto, by the way, after game three against Philly? When the wheels just came off and the Sixers just
did we bury them? I don't remember. That seems like 4 months ago. Did people bury them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. It was everything. The whole thing is coming apart at the seams. Kawhi's their only good player. Lowry is faltering in the postseason again. He's wobbling, and Marc Gasol looks 1,000 years old, and they don't have a second best player unless Siakam's great. And if Siakam's off, they don't have anybody. Who do they have? I mean, there was a lot of hand wringing after game three.
Okay. Let me talk myself in. Well, I don't need to talk you in because you're in. All those guys are going to play better. Giannis is not going to shoot 5 of 16. Bledsoe at some point is going to stop being a total train wreck. He's shooting 9 of 38, I think, in the series. I think that's correct. 2 of 17 on threes. And he does this thing where there's such a fine line between like empowering your players and letting them kind of venture a little bit too far in order to maintain their confidence. He took a few pull-up jumpers in this game, including early in the fourth quarter. I'm like, dude, you can't. That's just a bad shot with like 18 on the shot clock, and I get that you're trying to. When he's in his own head and in a slump, you can see him being like, I got to get aggressive. I got to work myself out of it. And he ends up erring on the side of like being a little hyper. He just, at some point, he's going to work himself out of this, but he's been pretty bad since the Detroit series, and he's got, which was not a series, a real series, and he's got to show up at some point. And Middleton is 3 of 16. He's averaging 11 points a game in the series on 33% shooting. I think guarding Kawhi, which he's doing a splendid job of, is taking its toll on him. And yes, by the way, he is doing a splendid job despite Kawhi averaging 32 points a game in the series or whatever. He's doing a great job. All of those points are arduous. It's like I'm getting tired watching Kawhi try to score points in this series. So you can say, oh, that's all those performances will turn around. Okay, but Hill, Brogdon, Connaughton gave you 52 points on like 70% shooting, and in game three, the Raptors shot 40% on twos, which was one of their four or five worst games of the year on twos. Now, part of that is because they're being forced to take a crap ton of mid-range shots and like nothing at the rim, because that's what playing against the Bucks is. And look, it's only, I think, four total games worth of numbers now, so maybe it is still just noise. But Giannis hasn't looked comfortable against Kawhi all season. I wrote in my preview of this series that the big question would be, when does one of these guys move over to guard the other? And what I wrote was, when that happens, it will be because the team is losing. And that's exactly what happened. And it only took till game three. And Giannis hasn't been able to figure out Kawhi. Now, maybe it's coming. And they did a much more aggressive and good job double-teaming Giannis early. And he threw some nice passes and he threw some bad passes. By the way, Giannis is not an accurate passer. I think that's the next step for him. If you watch a lot of his passes to shooters, they come in low, a little bit low, not all the time, a little bit. I mean, he threw some great passes yesterday, including one to the corner. I think it was to Connaughton maybe, just like a LeBron one-handed slingshot to the corner. But sometimes they're a little off when he's spinning around and that kind of stuff. And if they can if that's real, if Kawhi is really screwing up Giannis' life, here's the other stat that gives me hope for Toronto. In this series, Milwaukee's half-court offense, 0.8 points per possession,
Yeesh.
Which would have been last in the league by a mile, is last among the conference finalists, and is the eye test says they're getting all these transition threes. Like Toronto's transition defense was terrible. These guys walked into open threes over and over again, trail threes and this and that. They didn't match up properly. You can clean that up. I don't know where the evidence is that Milwaukee can score against Toronto in the half court. That's what gives me hope as someone who wants a 7-game series.
And yet, I feel like if Giannis finds that room to operate, the Bucks supporting cast and all those 3-point shooters and the ability of Brogdon and Bledsoe when he's not in his own head to create as secondary playmakers next to Giannis, I feel like I have more confidence in a lot of ways in them than I do in some of the Raptors supporting cast. You know, Siakam kind of has just kind of like, you know, wavered in and out of things over the last couple of weeks, which is to be expected.
I mean, he had 25 last night on 18 shots. People are acting like he played an okay game, and I understand he looks a little wild. He had 25 points, 2 of 5 from 3, made a couple corner threes that day badly. I thought Siakam was way more good than bad last night.
Last night, yes. But we've seen him at other points in these playoffs look like a young guy who's still kind of just finding his way. Who's like this is the first season he's been this guy. He was just drafted, what, 3 years ago? 27th overall pick? I mean, this is the thing about this series. So much of this is depending on players who have never been anywhere near this before. Giannis has never been this deep. Most of the Bucks, or at least some of the key Bucks, have never been this deep. Probably all of the key Bucks have never been this deep.
Except for George Hill, who's turned into, like, turned back the clock.
So this is the first for everybody, except for Kawhi and Danny Green, really. Marc Gasol's been in a conference finals before. But there's
Ibaka.
Ibaka. But who, again, like, we're, you know, never know what you're getting from him from night to night either.
14 minutes last night is really hard to play. And by the way, I don't question it. Gasol was playing his best game of the series by far. But when you're down to like 7 or 8 now reliable players and 2 of them have fouled out and you only get 14 minutes, that's a surprise.
Well, also shocking, would you have predicted that there would be a single playoff game where you saw Marc Gasol play 45 minutes at this stage of his career?
You know, I part of the reason I'm going to pick. I have a column coming out tomorrow focused on trying how the Raptors can make Kawhi's life a little easier on offense. And in the column, I predict Milwaukee is going to win Game 4. And part of the reason is I just feel like the minutes distribution has been better for them all season. I mean, Bud has a little Kerr in him where he's going to sit Giannis at his normal time in the first and third quarters, no matter what the score is. He's going to play a lot of guys, no matter what the score is. And I do think there's some evidence that has long-term benefits. And you throw in Kawhi appearing to tweak his leg last night early in the game and then proceeding to play 52 minutes and Gasol being 32, 33, whatever he is, and playing 45 minutes. I'm a little more worried about the bounce-back factor for the Raptors than I am for the Bucks.
Agreed, and especially because Kawhi did look good and gimpy at times in that game and played a lot of minutes. And as we sit here on the Monday at 3:25, I don't think we've had any kind of update on his health.
Here's the update we're going to get. No update. Kawhi's playing. He's fine. That's the update.
Yeah. Yeah. That there's a rant for another day, injury reporting in this league, which I feel like is getting worse all the time.
Well, Windy had, you know, I have sort of left the gambling stuff to other people, including Windy. Not left, I'm not as well versed in it as I need to be, nor am I quite as interested in it as some other people are. But Henry Abbott and Brian Windhorst have both written thoughtful pieces of, like, what are gamblers who aren't, like, the sharp, sharp, sharp dudes who somehow know that is going to get the Iron Throne at the end of Game of Thrones.
Spoiler alert.
There is no spoilers anymore. How does the regular person, how is it fair that we come out, we only learn that Damian Lillard has separated ribs, whatever that is. What does that mean? With the gap between two of his ribs is now larger than normal?
I didn't know that was a thing, yeah.
I don't know what that means.
I didn't know either.
We only know that because he's playing badly and somebody decided to anonymously let people know why he's playing badly. Oh, and by the way, it's not the Oregonians' fault that they aggregated somebody. I think it might have been Skip Bayless, but I'm not 100% sure. Calling them the Trash Brothers, McCollum and Lillard, after Game 3. and it's not even just that. Like, there are lots of people, oh, the Blazers are lucky to be here. They're a fluke. This is their true place in the league. Second best backcourt in the league. My ass. What a disappointment. Stop. Stop. Without Nurkic, they're a thin team. Yes. Hood hyperextends his knee. They have had and suffering the humiliation of last season, which would have broken up a lot of teams, to get this far and lose three straight games to the Warriors, the second of which was there for the taking, the third of which they were up by whatever at halftime. Shockingly, the Warriors came out in the third quarter and turned the game around. I don't want to hear anything about Portland's season except what a wonderful season it is. Damian Lillard has two of the six series-clinching shots in the history of life, of human life, and scored 50 points in one of those games. And now, 2 weeks later, people are like, oh, boy, if James Harden were doing what Damian Lillard did right now, he'd be vilified. Hey, guess what? Damian Lillard's in the conference finals, and he freaking won two series with buzzer shots. You know what that buys you? Credibility.
Yes. And benefit of the doubt. And, yeah, I mean, I can't believe this is even a thing right now. The Blazers have had an incredible season by any standard. Nobody would have predicted them to be in the conference finals even before they lost Nurkic. You would have had a hard time finding people who actually believed
and people
they were
are
a conference
sweeping
finals
on how good Nurkic was this year because they got the first two rounds without him.
He was their second best player at the time he went down, and that's no disrespect to CJ McCollum whatsoever. But if you ask the Blazers, I think they would tell you at the time Nurkic went down, he was their second most important player.
CJ McCollum is like the bionic man. Does he ever get tired? I don't understand it. He leads the league in miles run every season. They play this four overtime game where Dame looks gassed for the last 30 minutes of it and has looked gassed before that and has looked gassed since. And CJ is just like doing his thing.
Yeah.
Pull up two, bam, pull up two, bam. Anyway, I don't know what the hell we were talking about. Giannis and Kawhi and our hopes for a competitive series here. Listeners, you know I like anything that can save me time, and SeatGeek has emerged as the go-to time saver for buying tickets to anything, NBA playoffs, any other sporting event, concerts, comedy shows, Broadway shows, more. SeatGeek has all the tickets you're looking for. It searches the entire secondary market almost and puts it all in one place that's super easy to use. It rates every deal on a scale of 1 to 10. It has green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It has an interactive seating map so you know exactly where your seat is, whether anything's in the way, all of that stuff. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It is by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. They help me get tickets to Hamilton, which is a tough ticket to get. SeatGeek will, for now, even give you $10 off your first purchase. All you need to do is use the promo code I'm about to tell you about. You got to download the SeatGeek app, use promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast, bam, $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code LOWE for $10 off your first purchase on SeatGeek. So I am picking Milwaukee to win tomorrow. I do think Toronto has figured out some things that are interesting. Gasol being aggressive is huge for them. They just need him to shoot. They need.
There's a theme we haven't heard for the last 10 years.
Well, how they lose this series is Kawhi pick and rolls. And you can see they're trying to get Kawhi and Lowry some runway for off the dribble threes or just drives by setting these picks for them at the logo, like really high picks, because they know that Lopez is going to drop back at least a little bit, and they can get space that way, and they just can't get any separation from Middleton. But the way they lose is those pick and rolls, they get into two-point range, and Ibaka and Gasol do the little short roll into 18-foot range and take floaters and mid-range jumps. That, you're out. You lose. The math says you lose. You lose over 90 possessions that you lose. Now, if Gasol can catch there and spot someone open and make a pass to Siakam for a corner three like he did at some point in the marathon crunch time last night, fine. But that's how you lose. But they need Gasol to be aggressive. They need this Kawhi on Giannis thing to be real. And I'm interested to see how the Bucks, now knowing that that is coming, try to ease Giannis's life in game four. Because Kawhi's a beast, man. He's an absolute beast.
Yeah, and it's fun getting to see him back to this and going mano a mano with Giannis. And it's been, I've had a story on Kawhi last week. Just the idea that a guy who was almost, I don't want to say forgotten. We moved so quickly in this league, but the...
Yeah, the Trash Brothers now. That's how quickly people moved.
My God. Yeah, by the way, just to quickly go back, circle back to that, anybody who's killing the Oregonian for the tweet, which was obviously aggregating other people's takes, and then the people that are saying that's the Oregonian calling him that, maybe the tweet could have been written a little bit more artfully to make sure that they were insulating themselves and knowing, pointing out this was not them, but people getting on them, and the idea that somehow the Oregonian is the hometown paper supposed to be somehow supportive, hearkening back to Durant and the Oklahoman way back in the day, people just freaking chill. Anyway.
Amen.
I like seeing Kawhi back to MVP caliber Kawhi, the guy that you had at the top of your ballot for MVP two seasons ago, and that we, I think, legitimately wondered if we would see at the same level again, given all the weirdness of his last season in San Antonio and the leg injury and the load management, which at least I think hazed up the image a little bit of okay, well, then is he really okay? And I think what we've seen in these playoffs is dudes as great as he was back then. He, like, by his own assessment, he's not all the way back. He needs a full offseason of working out at a high level instead of just rehabbing, instead of just nursing himself back to health. He needs a full offseason of just working back at his pre-injury level. And then he thinks he'll be 100% next season. But if this isn't quite 100% still, if this is still like 90% or 95% of what MVP caliber Kawhi was two seasons ago, the guy is going to be fantastic wherever he is next season.
And I tweeted this earlier in the playoffs, like before the game 7 four bounce shot, dating to when he won the finals MVP in 2014. This is a guy who has, for all the, we sit here and we nitpick and we pick apart, is Steph Curry underperforming in the playoffs? Well, it turns out no. Is James Harden underperforming in the playoffs? Yeah, maybe. Maybe some. Chris Paul's never made a conference finals. Is that relevant? Yeah, kind of. It's interesting. Maybe it says some things about 6-foot point guards and their ability to be the best player on a championship team. It's all interesting. This dude is consistently even better in the playoffs than he is in the regular season. He is a monster in the playoffs. I mean, some of the plays he had last night, these steals, where he's literally in two places at the same time. You know how hard it is to double the post? I remember who was even playing. Middleton was posting up, I think, on a switch. To double the post one pass away, I mean, and not half double, he's there, and steal the pass back out, you're literally in two places at once to do that. And then to corral the ball on, this is a crazy play. This guy has consistently been a playoff monster. However, they are not going to win this series with Kawhi just isolating from the top of the key over and over again. It's not going to be good enough.
Do we think it matters for free agency?
Look, maybe I'm dumb. I am dumb about many things. Okay, so maybe I'm naive about this. I said last week, I don't know what the percentage chance is. I said maybe it's 30. I think there's a chance he stays, and I've said that all year.
No, I think it's a good chance he stays.
Everyone, there are lots of people in the know who laugh at me and say, it's done. It's done. It's already done. It's already happening. He's got the house out there. He wants to. It's cold in Toronto. I don't know if you know this. It's often cold there.
Never heard of that.
I should probably check the weather tomorrow because I've been caught off guard by May in Toronto a couple times in this glorious Raptors era.
It just became spring here in New York like yesterday.
Yeah,
so,
it's summer already. Now, if they had gotten rolled in this series, maybe that leaves a sour taste in your mouth. Like we're pretty far away from this Bucks team that's rising, and Lowry's older and Gasol's older, and I don't know really where my future is here other than Siakam. But if they turn this into a slugfest, and even if they lose, I don't know what the chances are, but I've said all year, I'm not ruling it out. I don't want to, 30 is about as high as a percentile that I'm even willing to guess at. Maybe it's less than that, but I think there is a chance that he stays.
I think there's a very good chance. I don't know if I would go higher than 30% or not. I think I would, actually. I think I'd go slightly higher than that. I think that he's had a very rewarding season there. They have made him feel comfortable at home, supported. Certainly physically, they've done everything possible. I had the quote from a rival GM in the story last week about the fact that, and this was something somebody said to me in December. Like, I filed this one away thinking, like, I didn't even know if I was ever going to use it. I was working on a different story at the time, but a rival GM had said back in December, if he stays, it may be because of Alex McKechnie, because of their director of player care, or Alex got his fancier title than that, which he deserves.
I just refer to him as the Silver Fox.
He is the Silver Fox. fans will know him by the guy with the white hair behind him.
Also had the best reaction of all their coaches to the Kawhi shot. He started just kind of shaking and pumping his fist like a little bobblehead doll behind the bench. He had the best of all the reactions.
Alex is awesome. And Alex is incredible at his job. And he is a genius, and he might be the best at what he does, not just in the NBA, but possibly all of sports in North America. And he has done everything possible, as have the Raptors, to get Kawhi back to where he is. And that will carry some weight, I think. I also think, as much as human emotion plays into this, and as much as we sometimes wonder whether or not Kawhi has human emotion, the reaction, the moment, the four bounce game winner, series winner, you can't just dismiss that out of hand. The everything that they all shared in that moment, the pure joy and just the thrill of it and the fan reaction, all the hugs all the way through the arena. I mean, that's not nothing. I mean, you make a decision in the cold light of day on July 1st based on all kinds of other, you know, factors. Weather, possibly, going home, possibly, money, all these things. Uncertainty about one team's roster or another's. You mentioned Lowry and Gasol. I'd be concerned. And if I'm the Clippers, I'm certainly, or anybody else, I'm playing on that. I'm going to keep telling them, listen, you guys had a really nice run, but, you know, how much more do Lowry and Gasol have in the tank? Who else do you have to grow with there? If I'm the Clippers, I'm certainly saying that. But I still don't think that means that he's leaving. I think that everything I just mentioned, the moments that they have shared in this postseason, the support he's had there, the comfort, being able to just feel like himself again for the first time after whatever the hell happened in San Antonio, the contrast in the way he feels right now has to matter.
I agree. I said as much last week. He has a moment now. You don't only get so many moments in your basketball career, capital M moments. And that was whenever's higher than capital, that was like when you put the font to like 26 on your, on your computer or whatever it is. That was that kind of moment. I'm very curious to see how the Bucks adjust knowing that the Kawhi matchup is coming. Now, I mean, obviously they knew it after the first part of the game, and they anticipated that this would be a part of the series at some point. But I always, whenever he has there's no one that's giving Giannis problems. Maybe Kawhi is the only one that could, like, even Horford couldn't sustain it. You know, he figured out that matchup. But anytime he has one of the four or five guys in the league who can legitimately give him some problems, one of the things I wish they would do a little more is put him in the pick and roll. Either side of it, because then you're putting them in a situation where they either have to switch or put themselves in rotation. And I don't think they use him as the ball handler in a pick and roll enough. And I know why they don't, because people are just going to go under picks and they don't think it's going to work. The numbers say it works really well. Hmm. The numbers in the playoffs are crazy. And I look at like late in one of the overtimes, I think they ran a Giannis Brook Lopez pick and roll. I think that's a super underutilized combination for the Bucks. The numbers are insane, given Lopez's shooting ability. They tend to gravitate toward Giannis Bledsoe, Giannis whoever has the smallest guy on him on the other team. And I think they need to do that even more. Like I think they're letting Van Vliet survive defensively more than he should be allowed to do. I think every time he's on the floor, they should be picking on Bam. Pick on Danny Green. Danny Green has no shot. I mean, they're going to switch. That's one they're actually going to switch voluntarily, because Danny Green's pretty big. He's guarding Bledsoe a lot, and I like the alignment where they have Green on Bledsoe, Siakam on Middleton, and Kawhi on Giannis, because you can switch their three key guys. Leave Lowry over on Mirotic. I think that's it. I think they should be finding Van Vliet, finding Lowry, and trying to hunt them. But I also think that Giannis Lopez, it's underutilized. And late in the game, they got a switch, and they had Gasol on him, on Giannis. And he kind of, like, just a little bit, like, he was surprised and lost his balance and tried to wrap a pass to somebody under the rim, and it was a disaster. If Kawhi's problematic, at some point you have to stop just going full bore at him one-on-one and try to lean a little bit more into other stuff.
Makes sense. And I don't know why they would shy away from that. You probably have more insight into that than I do. But it's, you know, I think they just, they love the idea of Giannis just being, this all-purpose creator, initiator who, you know, if you know, just dare you to stop him one-on-one.
I also like two other Bucks things I like. I like I keep writing this, and they haven't done it much. And maybe they're just afraid it's too small. I like when they put Giannis and Mirotić as the only big men on the floor. They've done that 87 minutes in the playoffs. They're plus 33. Only 21 minutes in this series. They're plus 6. Now, I understand in this series, Ilyasova had a crazy game in Game 2. Lopez had a crazy game in Game 1. So you're disincentivized from playing those lineups. I still think those are worth leaning into a little bit more for the Bucks. And there was something else I thought was interesting for the Bucks, but now I don't remember what it was. People, it's time for spring cleaning. And even though I'm bad at cleaning up my house, you can clean up your teeth with Quip. It's the easiest way to change your brushing habits. Just 2 minutes twice a day. You have a healthier mouth, healthier mind, everything. And now Quip, the electric toothbrush that changed the market for adults, has a size down kids electric toothbrush. And oh my God, getting my daughter to brush her teeth in the morning is a nightmare. Maybe she will like this. It has the same 2 minute timer and guiding pulses as the original version without any kid gimmicks. There's no princesses for the girls and trucks for the boys and all that stuff. They can brush like a grown up. Quip is just super easy to use. It has these little sensitive sonic vibrations that allow you to brush, but not too hard because some toothbrushes are too abrasive. Some electric toothbrushes even are too abrasive. It has a 2 minute timer that pulses every 30 seconds. So you know when to switch sides and you brush your entire mouth evenly. You're not lefty heavy or righty heavy. 90% of us actually don't brush for a full 2 minutes, according to Quip. That seems like a lot. Brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. So you're always fresh. It's one of the first electric toothbrushes. Quip is accepted by the American Dental Association, and they're backed by over 25,000 dental professionals. That seems like a lot, too. And they have thousands of verified five-star reviews. That's why a million happy, healthy users report to love Quip. And here's the thing. It starts at $25. When I first started reading this ad, I thought, well, this high-end electric toothbrush is going to cost $200. $25. And if you go to getquip.com/low, my last name, L-O-W-E, the name of this podcast, you can get your first refill pack free, $0.00. That's getquip.com/low. So let's switch gears. You said you wanted to talk a little bit about Durant and just the insanity of the Warriors being, I believe it's now 30-1 in their last 31 games where Steph plays and Durant does not, and 32-4 overall in such games since they signed Kevin Durant, who was on Twitter again today addressing this topic, shall we say. What's interesting about this is obviously interesting. What's interesting about it to you?
There's probably at least 3, 4, 5, 6 different things on this. But the first is this. Let's not be surprised that a team with Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, who's back to being the old cool, awesome, amazing Draymond is everywhere, that team, even if they don't have all the ancillary pieces that they had when this ran began in 2014-15, let's not be surprised that that team is really super good and that Steph Curry can put up MVP numbers as a guy who won back-to-back MVPs.
Yeah, is the Steph's not good in the playoffs thing over yet? Can we put that one to bed? Because even when he has these quiet games, like when Iguodala was finals MVP, relatively quiet, like 21 on whatever. Now, I believe he's still a 40% three-point shooter in the playoffs career, maybe better without looking it up. His scoring is not as consistently prolific. Like, he's had some stinkers. The nature of his game is pretty high variance. But I don't know how you can watch the Warriors, even with Durant, and not see how much of what they do stems from the fact that Steph has two guys on him 35 feet from the rim in a way that no one else in the league has ever had. Not even Damian Lillard has guys blitzing him to that degree and with that level of aggression. Now, you need another guy like Draymond Green, who's a genius, who can make plays in space as a big guy, as a screener. You need that. But, like, Steph is taking these lineups where it's like Steph, McKinney, Draymond, Looney, and Iguodala. With apologies to Iguodala, who everyone knows I'm just a straight up Andre fanboy who's shooting 38% from three in the playoffs. That's four crappy shooters in Stephen Curry. Yeah. And they're like, they're still just killing people. And what is the reason? It's because two guys are on Steph 35 feet from him. The most fundamental reason is that. Anyway.
He's, by the way, you're right, 0.404 career three-point shooter in the playoffs.
Choke artist.
We should not be surprised that the greatest shooting backcourt in the history of the game, plus Draymond Green, one of the most unique and essential defensive players we've ever seen, and certainly in this era, we should not be surprised that those guys, even with an eroded supporting cast, Iguodala and Livingston are not who they were a few years ago. The rest of those guys, I mean, it's incredible what Steve Kerr has essentially gotten away with in this playoff run in terms of some of the lineups he's had to run out there. They're not the strength in numbers group. They're not because they signed Kevin Durant and threw a few pieces overboard a couple of years ago, and that's fine. It's a top heavy model, and they have misfired on some picks and some signings. It's hard. It's really, when you're a champion or a contender year in, year out, we saw this with the Miami Heat team with LeBron. I saw it with the Warriors and with Shaq and Kobe. It's really hard. If you don't ace your pick at 29th or 30th and ace your mid-level exception signing or your veteran, like, it's hard. It's not to let anybody off the hook. I'm sure Bob Myers smacks himself all the time for some of the misfires they've had. Supporting cast not as good, but those three guys still really super good. And by the way, the Portland Trailblazers are missing a player who is either their second or third best player. So that the Warriors dominate in the regular season, even with just the three, even without Durant, this is more akin to that, Zach. And this is not a put down to the Portland Trailblazers by any means. But again, none of us expected them to be in the conference finals. So that the Warriors are able to consistently beat a team that in the regular season was consistently not as good as them, with or without Durant. If you had said we just had the other three guys for the Warriors and they could take on 80%, 90% of the league, would you still expect them to beat them 4 out of 7? You'd say yes. It's only a couple of teams that you would think, man, they really need Durant. And this is where it comes back around to this whole thing about, are they better off without him and all this bull? No, they need Durant. The proof is the last two championships they won after losing one to the Cavaliers and then destroying them the next two times, and Durant being the best player in both those series and winning MVP both those times.
Need is a strong word. I think they need him to be unbeatable.
They need him,
which is a standard that essentially no team has ever had to reach.
Sure. Okay, how about this? They need him. They have needed him to win the championship. They don't necessarily need him to get to the finals. Although, are they beating the Rockets in the conference finals a year ago without him?
See, I think it's hard. First of all, all of this always brings me back, and this is what I wrote about in March when it was clear the Lakers were going to miss the playoffs and the LeBron-Jordan thing was going to become a thing again. The series that I wish we got to see was 2017 finals, but in an alternate universe where the Warriors never signed Durant.
Agreed.
Maybe that finals doesn't exist because if he stays in Oklahoma City, maybe Oklahoma City makes the finals. But let's say
you just hurt Oklahoma fans right there. You just really just kicked them in the face just now.
I just stated a thing. I didn't mean to hurt anyone's feelings. That's the series that I really wish we could have seen, because that was the best Cavs team maybe ever, the 2017 Cavs, with Kyrie and Love and LeBron all rolling. And they just didn't have a chance, you know, and they got rolled in the first two games in Oakland, and the Cavs always came into Oakland for games 1 and 2, like shocked that they had to play this high level of basketball, and they would get destroyed by Leandro Barbosa, and you just name all these players, it would kill them in games 1 and 2. And after that, it was, you know, game 3, they lose in the Durant dagger, and then game 4, they rally and force us to go back to Oakland to close it out. But that's a series I wish I would have seen, because I think Cleveland, I don't know what the chances are. I think I might have picked Cleveland to win that series against the Harrison Barnes Warriors.
The Cavaliers, as you and I both well know, absolutely believe they could have and should have won in 2015 if they don't lose both Kyrie and Kevin Love. The Warriors win. The dynasty begins. The next year, Draymond is suspended and the Warriors lose. And the Cavs win, and the Cavs now believe they should have won back-to-back. That loss causes all the chain of events that leads Kevin Durant to the Warriors. Maybe he would have gone anyway. I don't know. But the Cavaliers at full strength with those three guys were really, really good.
That was a great team. That was a team that just absolutely obliterated the entire – and, like, you can say, oh, they killed the East. The East wasn't that good. I mean, it was almost as if they were participating in the D-League playoffs. They beat the East so badly. And you should not be able to beat any grouping of three playoff seeds as badly as they did.
And so did the Warriors need Kevin Durant They didn't need him to win 73 games in a regular season in which they decided the regular season was so important that they wanted to set a record. No, they didn't need him for that. That's true. They have won a lot of games before him. They won a championship before him. Did they need him at least, though, at the championship level? Did they need him to beat a Cavaliers team that had beaten them the year before?
I don't know. I don't know the answer. Wish I could. That's what I'm saying. I wish I could see the series.
Right. We'll never know. You can, you know, play all the simulations you want on NBA 2K or whatever. We don't know. But you can't, this idea that Kevin Durant is just, I mean, in some ways he is, yes, a luxury for most team, for this team in particular. But it doesn't mean that he wasn't essential to win these last two championships. He was more than essential. He was the difference.
I think he was less than essential.
You think they would have won those without him?
So again, this is something that's hard to reverse engineer, right?
Yeah.
So here, I'll link it to what's going on now. What's going on right now has forced me to recalibrate my expectations for them next season if Durant leaves. Because you watch them, and Nate Jones, who's a Twitter personality and agent, has been tweeting about this a lot over the years.
And Nate is great. Great follow on
Twitter. And he's tweeted, and I've agreed with him for most of the season, that you know, you can't just pencil these guys in as favorites in the West next year if Durant leaves, because the supporting cast is eroded, as you mentioned, and all these guys are a little older now. And I agreed with that all year. And I wrote a couple columns ago that there's this parlor game ongoing in the NBA where you talk to everyone at the combine, this and that. Like, like, what's the West pecking order next year if Durant leaves? Where do you put the Warriors? Do you put them above the Rockets? Do you put them above Utah? And I thought all season, like, they don't look great. Like, they don't look awesome, you know, when they're having block games and Durant's not going, and then you watch the Clippers series and they need Durant to go supernova to win a few of those games. And you start to think like, yeah, maybe there's just, maybe that, and then this happens. And I think it's made me recalibrate in this sense. I think it's hard for the non-Durant players to get to the gear that they need to be in to play this style when Durant is both on the floor and just and playing and in the rotation. So even when Durant's taking his 3 or 4 minute rests and Draymond and Steph are on the floor, I just feel like they're out of that. They get at, like, they need to play like they've played against Portland. They need to cut and screen, and everything needs to be 100 miles an hour, because no one other than Steph occasionally is just beating people one on one. It's a 5-man game, and those 5 guys need to just be totally locked in on every screen, every slip, every pass, every decision needs to, and it's, I think when they have Durant on the floor, you can see it sometimes with Curry. He doesn't move the same way. He'll give up the ball and realize, okay, this is not coming back to me. I'm just going to sort of walk around a little bit here on the wing, and Clay will do it. And I think now that they're back to playing this way, you are reminded of when they lock in, and also what happened is Draymond lost 23 pounds and got into shape and became Draymond Green again.
Small thing.
So this is, but not, yeah. And so this is sort of forced me to grapple with, like, I think the whole year I let recency bias, what I'm seeing on the floor now, how they're playing with Durant, how Draymond looks like 80% of what he used to be, I think to a degree that became inaccurate, color my perception of what this team could look like next year if Durant leaves. I think, by the way, if he leaves, I bet Draymond comes in shape next year and stays in shape, because I think they're going to be hungry to. I think they're enjoying this, not out of any animosity to KD, but I think any human nature. Let's remind people what we are. Let's remind people what this looks like when we play like this.
Absolutely. Just as KD wants to remind people, I can carry a team, or show people I can carry a team. I don't have to be viewed as this, bandwagon hopper or whatever people wanted to say about his joining the Warriors. Both parties, the Warriors on one hand and KD on the other, if they go their separate ways, will have motivation, as you note. It's a human feeling to want to prove something, and that's fine. And what you just described of the Warriors, Zach, of the way that they play when he's during a stretch like this where they don't have him, how precise they have to be, how coordinated they have to be, the 5-man game and the beautiful basketball that they played. And that's like the team that everybody kind of like fell in love with when they were darlings before they became villains. That was a team that everybody in the, you know, people, even non-Warrior fans, people across the country, that they loved that team. That team was fun and embraceable. And then they got KD and suddenly it was like a big heel turn by the whole franchise as far as the public was concerned, and people started resenting them and they got sick of them and all this other bullshit. It's not that team didn't still exist. They clearly do. I do think that the motivations or the rationale that led them to wanting to sign KD, other than, hey, there's a crazy cap spike and we have a bunch of room and he's available, they saw in that loss to the Cavaliers that sometimes we're going to struggle in crunch time against a really great defensive team in a big playoff series or the finals. We're going to struggle to manufacture a shot. We need a guy who can do that. They got one of the best in the game. They got KD. If he leaves, yeah, they'll go probably have another like 62-win regular season, and they'll probably go on another deep playoff run. Is there going to come a moment, though, where they feel like they need that guy again who can just manufacture out of thin air?
Yes, there will.
Yeah. And so the style of ball that you described that is at the heart of who the Warriors are and who they've been for this era, like it's no small thing.
So,
but yeah,
Van Gundy and Jackson and Breen were talking about this during Game 3. The idea that the Warriors just break your will, and you could see it happening to Portland. They've broken the Blazers. The Blazers just don't believe anymore they can win. And I agree that that happened. It'd be interesting to see if the Blazers come out and think they can win tonight. We'll see. But what that means to me, watching that game on television and watching the Warriors for all these years up close and on TV, talking to people who have played against them a lot, what breaking their will means to me is they string together three or four possessions where it's just too fast for the other team, where you need to rotate four different times in 2.5 seconds because of the way they move the ball, and you're tired and they're already beating you, and you can see just like, man, I can't, that's just too fast. Like to me, breaking their will, it's not that they're physically imposing themselves on you, although, you know, they're a physical-ish team sometimes. It's not that their fast break is too fast for you, which sometimes it is. It's their half-court offense. The passing comes so fast that you just can't handle it anymore, and you can see the shoulder slump. It's like, oh, man, it's too fast. Can't do it. Can't get there. Yeah. Can't make the fourth rotation.
There's absolutely something to that. I think, you know, look, you're, as you do, describing this in a much more nuanced way. The extreme version of this is they're better off without him. That's not the same thing as them being great with or without him and just being different. And you're drawing the line between him being important versus essential, or whatever two words you might choose there. But it's not the same as this people trotting out the whatever it is now, 32-1 or whatever, and saying they don't need him. He's not important. They're better off without. Like those conclusions are just stupid. You're using a stat to draw a stupid conclusion.
People, you know I like anything that makes life easier and less time-consuming, and ZipRecruiter is the place to do that if you are hiring. It sends your job posting to over 100 of the web's leading job boards all at once, so you don't have to go one by one and hope, oh my gosh, are the right people seeing this? It has powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience for you and invites them proactively to apply for your job. And as those applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes everyone, spotlights the top candidates. You do no work. It does all the work for you, and you get the best candidates sent right to you. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of every 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free, literally nothing, at this exclusive address, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. The name of this podcast is ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, LOWEPOST, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. I'm now going to cede the floor to you.
Uh-oh.
Because you said you wanted to talk about this. Today brought the 4th, 5th, 6th, I don't know where we are, installment of the ongoing screwball comedy that is the 2018-19 Los Angeles Lakers. It's like the Naked Gun 33 1/3. I think we're on the Lakers like 44.5.
But all the Naked Gun movies were uproarious and great, and the Lakers are not.
A little uncomfortable with OJ.
We talked about this. I have some friends who were like, we're all like really, really big Naked Gun fans.
Norberg.
And when Norberg broke bad, when whatever the hell happened with O.J. Simpson, we had long discussions about whether or not we would still find Naked Gun movies funny.
So Magic went on First Take today, and in a very illuminating and very long interview, didn't so much throw people under the bus as pick up the bus and throw it at them and smack them in the head with an actual bus. And then apparently Frank Vogel was introduced as the head coach at some point today. I cede the floor to you.
It's nice that this happened. Like, the timing is just great. Like, Magic, not only is it the same day as Vogel's introduction, but it was the morning after the Thrones finale, which meant there were plenty of available dragon torching things memes for people to unearth. Actually, I guess most of the torching was from a week ago. But still, very nice that and Game of Thrones, which of course has been used to analogize the Lakers for the last couple of years anyway, Jeannie Buss as Daenerys Targaryen, as the queen, as basically just offing anybody who challenged her. That's gotten to be a very dark analogy now. I'm not sure Jeannie still wants the Daenerys label. Here's what I would say. All the current stuff aside, some of this is not going to matter. A lot of this is just going to blow by us. Unless Magic keeps doing interviews, and maybe he will, that's going to go away. That's a sideshow. Some of the things Magic said, especially about Rob Pelinka, do matter. Matt Barnes weighed in on Twitter and actually, like, affirmed the idea that, yeah, we all think that Rob Pelinka is a bad dude. Like, I can't remember what Barnes'
words
were.
Yeah, Matt Barnes got in the bus and started it up and then backed it over everybody who was
again,
under there.
Yeah. He got his own dragon and retorched Rob Pelinka. Those things will linger. Whatever distrust there is, whatever instability there is, potentially will, I think, linger. What really matters, as always, is what happens next. And what happens next is they've already made it clear they're not hiring anybody to replace Magic. So now Rob Pelinka's...
To not even try is inexplicable. And now I cede the floor back to you.
It is inexplicable. Look, I don't expect them to follow our advice or the general NBA's advice, but you, me, every other person who's weighed in on this, everybody around the NBA, other executives, other agents, coaches, whoever, everybody thought the same thing essentially, which was, oh, Magic left. This is a blessing in disguise. You have a chance to reset. You have a chance to hire a real front office now, figure out what to do with Rob Pelinka, but hire yourself an experienced front office. Maybe go get David Griffin. Next thing you know, David Griffin's taking a job in New Orleans. And
by the way, before I cede the floor back to you, some of those people laugh at the Lakers, like, who's going to take that job? I'll tell you, some of the people would take that job.
Yeah, if they had bothered asking.
It's the Lakers.
Yeah.
If you ask, you can get those people in a room and make a pitch.
But they didn't bother to ask. All of that is still troubling. What matters going forward is that they did not really actually fix anything. They filled a coaching vacancy. They got a good coach in Frank Vogel. I'll be interested to see how he and LeBron get on.
I'm now calling him Hollywood Frankie. Hollywood Frankie Vogel.
They got a coach, a good coach. Best fit coach for LeBron? Don't know. But they got a good, accomplished coach. They got an assistant coach who's polarizing at best, who may or may not have been somebody that the head coach himself wanted. These are all still troubling things. I think what matters going forward is not what Magic Johnson says, but what the Lakers are and are trying to be. And I'm still not sure what it is. And a quick aside on this, and one of the reasons why I still wanted to talk about this, even though your appetite for anything Lakers
it's not the Lakers. It's I do think there is something to the idea that the league should have an interest in reminding people that the most important basketball games are going on right now. The whole point of all of this is to be playing in these games. The whole point, and this is the second time by virtue of being a complete big top circus with elephants pooping everywhere like the goats pooping in Phoenix. The Lakers have trumped what should be the moment where the NBA is telling people, and it's not like the NBA can orchestrate this and tell Magic not to go on first take and this and that, although they could. They might try. You know, we keep hearing this like, oh, you know, are people going to watch the Bucks? Are the Bucks going to be a ratings draw? This guy is the next best player in the NBA. He should be LeBron. He should be a ratings draw. Like, the NBA should have more of an interest in it's the media's fault too. It's all of our fault. Like, these are the whole point of this is to be playing these games on May 20th.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about those games. So we are, but a lot of people aren't.
No, the Lakers have a habit and a talent for hijacking the conversation. And they have. And the interesting thing here too is, like, people say, oh, LeBron's barely even part of this. This is all just them, really. Or 98% them. This is not LeBron's doing. This is Jeannie Buss is doing. This is Magic Johnson's doing. It's Rob Pelinka's doing.
Apparently, it's Tim Harris's doing. the CEO for wanting to defend something else. I don't know his whole title, for wanting to keep Luke Walton as coach. And this is part of the whole thing. Is like, so the Magic's unhappy that Pelinka's apparently backstabbing him, according to Magic. According to Magic, I said.
Yes.
To the aggregators. And Tim Harris, according to Magic, steps in front of his decision to fire Luke Walton. And so Magic concludes, well, I don't have the power here. And so then he says, well, too many of these people have Genie Buss's ear, this and that. That's Genie Buss's fault. Like, if Magic can't make the decisions he wants to make, that's the owner's fault. That's fundamentally the owner's fault.
So last week, somebody suggested to me, and asking me this specifically because I covered them back in the Shaq and Kobe era, 97 to 2004, specifically for my years, is this like that? Because somebody else had suggested it was like, it's always been this way. Well, Lakers, they always produce drama. They're always like, it's all palace intrigue. It's just the Lakers. To which I say, bullshit. Absolutely not. This is not the same. Yes, the Lakers have always had a penchant for high stakes drama and intrigue, some infighting, all kinds of stuff. But this is not the same at all. Not only were they winning three straight championships at the time and going to the finals 4 out of 5 years, and yes, arguably, if not for the feuding between Shaq and Kobe in particular, maybe they would have won 4 titles or 5, but they did still win 3. It's not just that. Yeah, like all teams have some tensions. Most of them. Some infighting, some feuding, ego clashes, whatever. It can happen. But what the Lakers still had back then, despite all of that, was stability. Phil might be fighting with Kobe or Shaq at any given time. Shaq and Kobe might be fighting with each other. Phil and Jerry West had their tensions. Jerry West and Genie had their tensions, even when Genie was just on the business side, because when Genie started dating Phil Jackson, that really kind of unnerved Jerry West. Jerry West and Jerry Buss, underrated part of this, Jerry West and Jerry Buss had their tensions at times. These things happen, and sometimes they became stories, and sometimes they became big stories. But there was a stability that and a foundation there that you never stopped believing in the Lakers' ability to win or to attract talent. Karl Malone and Gary Payton in 2003 went there at dramatic, massive pay cuts to play alongside Shaq and Kobe and to chase a ring. Horace Grant went there. Ron Harper went there. All these guys, Mitch Richmond toward the end of his career wanted to sign up for it. Like, guys, people came because they wanted to be part of it and because they trusted that organization, no matter what else was going on. And mostly in that time, it was Shaq and Kobe who were doing all the fighting. It wasn't the front office turning on each other, and it wasn't – no one was ever around the league wondering if the Lakers knew what the hell they were doing or whether they would sabotage themselves from within or whether they were capable of making smart decisions. They did hire Phil Jackson at a time when Phil Jackson was the best there was. And there was a stability. And now part of that, too, is that Jerry West was in the front office there for 30-whatever years. And when he was done, he handed the baton to Mitch Kupchak, who had been with him for the majority of that time. And so it was seamless. And Mitch had his run. And Mitch got them Pau Gasol, and they won a couple more titles. It was at the end of the essentially the Jerry-Mitch era and the beginning of the Genie Buss era, coincidentally, where they had to finally make a break with the past, where it was like, well, you know, Mitch's time had run out, and he and Jim Buss go out together, and now Genie's got to hire somebody. But for the longest time, they had a certain stability because it was Jerry West, and then it was his hand-picked right-hand person in Mitch Kupchak. And what they have now is an instability and a lack of direction, maybe even lack of conviction, that is undermining them. And this is not what was going on back when Shaq and Kobe were fighting with each other. This is on a completely different scale, and it speaks more to a franchise-level instability as opposed to just, you know, some personalities that weren't getting along on a given day. It's not analogous at all, and if anybody draws that analogy, they're off their rocker. This is much worse.
Okay.
There you go.
That's it. I'm not going to add anything.
Feel free to disagree with any piece of that, but that's what was kind of on my mind leaving Chicago last week after somebody had drawn this, I think, very bad analogy. Which, by the way, in Chicago last week, where you saw the Weber Grill sticking out of the building for the first time?
Never noticed that before.
That has been there for...
I know. People told me 15, 20 years.
That and the big frog coming out of the Rainforest Cafe.
Times. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, how do you,
apparently,
like,
that's a child friendly. That's like you would take your kid there to the Rainforest
never,
Cafe.
Never been. I like the frog, though.
I was walking to a meeting at a restaurant with a source who I met at the same restaurant after making the same walk from the same hotel last year, and I never noticed the grill before. I'm beginning to think I don't look up enough. I need to look up sometime. I need to like my gaze needs to be 10% higher, because I'm missing part of it. Is everyone's looking at their phones, so you're looking down more.
Sadly,
I need to look up and see the world. And you know what you see? You see the Weber Grill.
You see the Weber Grill sticking out of a building.
I didn't know that they had a restaurant. Apparently, it's good too.
I've never been to the restaurant.
I think next time I got to go.
I'm a big fan of the Big Bowl, though, which is right in that same vicinity. I love the Big Bowl.
Okay. I love Chicago. Chicago in the spring. These Midwestern cities in the spring are just unbelievable.
They're different places.
They gain the net gain from winter to summer, and they still, like New York, it's too hot in the summer. They stay right on the line where you want to be in the summer. They're just delightful. I will be going to Toronto tomorrow, and then the finals will begin soon. And I'll be going to Milwaukee for game 5 now too. So I'll be back in another Midwestern city soon. Howard Beck, read your recent Kawhi piece. A lot of good Nick Nurse stuff in there. Some Steve Fisher stuff, if I recall.
Yes, little Steve Fisher. He was great.
Off the top of my head. Read all of your stuff at Bleacher Report. Listen to the full 48. Who's on the full 48 this week, can you say?
Still efforting at this moment. The one currently up is the one I taped with Jonathan Wasserman, our draft guru, last week from Chicago to set the top 10 post-lottery and talk about AD and Zion and all kinds of
stuff.
You
had another big one recently. Who was it? I listened to part of it. Why am I blanking on who it was? It was a big one.
Kelly Alcoin from Billions?
That was one. He's Dollar Bill, right?
He's Dollar Bill. He's the best.
And
my fellow Park Slope resident.
You had the Game of Zones guys on.
Had the Malamut
Brothers. That was delightful.
Yes. They were fantastic.
So anyway, listen to the full 48. Read everything Howard does. And thank you, as always, for your time on the Low Post podcast. We will be seeing you soon in likely Oakland and Eastern Conference City, TBD. The great Howard Beck. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.